Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, I'll have an interview with Catherine Joyce from The Nation, a segment on homophobic Oklahoma State Representative Sally Kern, and more analysis, yes, of the Elliot Spitzer scandal. Also, Horton hears a womb? In all the angles of covering this year's March Madness, I have to tip my hat to NPR for finding the funniest. The Oregon Urology Institute is advertising March Madness vasectomies. Get sterilized and have the perfect excuse to sit on the couch for 4 days not moving and watching the game.
March Madness is a good time to have a vasectomy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's so popular now. And just to have an opportunity.
I'm not sure popular is the word. They're common now.
Oh, no. The March Madness is popular.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes.
And then the opportunity to have 4 days of ability to watch March Madness uninterrupted and have a legitimate excuse or a legitimate reason to watch it is an absolutely wonderful combination. This was supposed to be a little low-budget, kind of a local thing to see if it would push some guys over, and the thing has just blown up on us.
There's something kind of beautiful about this. Feminist-minded sports fans I know often wonder how to reclaim sports from the cult of sexism that surrounds it. This is a small step towards that goal. Watch the games in service of taking on your fair share of the family planning responsibility, guys. It's the dictionary definition of a win-win situation. If you haven't heard the homophobic rant from Oklahoma State Representative Sally Kern that's flying around, well, I highly recommend you listen to it. She was speaking to a group of 50 people, and one of them, unbeknownst to her, was not a fellow traveler, and instead taped the rant and exposed her.
The homosexual agenda is destroying this nation. Okay, it's just a fact. Not everybody's lifestyle is equal, just like not all religions are equal. You know, the very fact that I'm talking to you like this here today puts me in jeopardy, okay? And I'm not gay bashing, but according to God's word, that is not the right kind of lifestyle. It has deadly consequences. For those people involved in it, they have more suicides, and they're more discouraged, there's more illness, their lifespans are shorter, you know. It's not a lifestyle that is good for this nation. Matter of fact, studies show that no society that has totally embraced homosexuality has lasted more than, you know, a few decades. So it's the death knell of this country.
I'm stopping here because that's a good place to inject my concerns about the widespread distribution of this tape. I mean, I think it's great that this is getting play. People are seeing the ugliness and the hate behind all the talk of preserving traditional marriage and other code words. But I'm worried that it's going to turn into this thing where Sally Kern is individually blamed, and there's not a larger discussion about how these are commonly held beliefs, that these myths she's spouting are memorized and recited by every Bible-thumping wingnut out there. It's BS that there's a long history of cultures embracing homosexuality and then collapsing immediately, but all these wingnuts have heard this lie and they believe it. As I wrote this, I decided to go check Conservapedia's stat page to see what the popular searches are. I did this months ago on RealityCast and not much has changed. Besides the main page, 8 of 9 top searches are all about homosexuality, with stuff like homosexuality and anal cancer up there in the top searches. These people are friggin' obsessed. Anyway, back to Sally Kern.
I honestly think it's the biggest threat even that our nation has, even more so than terrorism or Islam, which I think is a big threat. Okay? Because what's happening now, they're going after in schools. 2-year-olds, you know why they're trying to get early childhood education? They want to get our young children into the government schools so they can indoctrinate them. I taught school for close to 20 years, and we're not teaching facts and knowledge anymore, folks. We're teaching indoctrination, okay?
It's kind of entertaining listening to someone who can't actually speak without lying or being ignorant, isn't it? That Islam is the same thing as terrorism. That preschools are like some anal sex orgy. What's really making her mad is that a school kid might be exposed to people that are not exactly like the folks at home and realize, oh my God, that people can be different. And that's not only okay, but it makes the world a better, more interesting place. Well, I won't bore you with the hate any longer, but I will point out that Ellen DeGeneres was awesome enough to take this on.
Okay, I feel like there's some misinformation going on here, and I think I need to call her. I think... she's clearly just mistaken. She's talked to someone and they've confused her. I think I could doubt she'll answer. Trying to figure out which societies have disappeared that we don't know about.
You've reached the Office of Representative Sally Kern. We're unable to answer the phone at the moment. Thank you for calling. Have a great day.
Sorry, cannot leave a message now because this user's mailbox is full.
I bet.
It's funny, but again, I caution against focusing too much on Sally Kern, and think of the big picture here. She's not one individual nut spouting off into the darkness. Her form of hatred is widely held by a lot of Americans, unfortunately. She's a tree, but there's a forest here. I'd like to welcome Catherine Joyce to the program. Catherine is the author of Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement, due out from Beacon Press in February 2009. Her work has also appeared in The Nation and on Alternet. She's here today to talk about an article she wrote for The Nation about the way the anti-choice movement has latched onto race panics as a tactic. Welcome to RealityCast, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
In your article, you described what seems to be an escalation of rhetoric and policies built around the idea that Europe is facing a demographic winter. What do people think is happening, and what are they so afraid of?
Well, the demographic winter is a new idea that's being floated by a section of the anti-choice Christian life movement that calls itself the pro-family movement. And they're argument basically is that Europe has failed to have enough babies, and the real point to that is they mean Europe is failing to have enough white Christian, so-called Western babies, and they are going to be supplanted by an immigrant Muslim population. And the blame for this, they kind of lay at the feet of all their familiar enemies, and that would be, of course, abortion, birth control, women's careers and working, gay rights, kind of secularism, everything that runs the gamut there.
So here's the fun chicken or egg question. A lot of the folks raising the alarm are anti-choicers from the Pope on down. Does this scare tactic stem from racist organizing more, or is it more of a way for anti-choicers to get sympathy for their cause?
I think that it's more of the latter. I think that nativist motivations and this kind of nationalism that they're tapping into, that's really just opportunistic. That's a way that they can appeal to a larger crowd. In Europe right now, there are a lot of kind of latent nationalist feelings being stirred up by immigration conflicts. You'll see things like in Switzerland, there will be posters, campaign posters, with a flock of white sheep kicking a black sheep out of their pasture, and it will read this legend for greater security. So it's really tapping into these feelings, but kind of on a very subtle level. What their main message is that, you know, Europe has been too permissive, too liberal, too modernistic, and look where you are now. Now you're dealing with these immigration conflicts you weren't prepared for. And so I really see the racist motivations more as just something that they're tapping into, something that's opportunistic that will help draw support for their cause.
And a lot of the energy that's being poured into this cause is here in the U.S., correct?
Yeah, that's the thing about them. Particularly the World Congress of Families is kind of the flagship of this pro-family movement, and that is It is an international conference and an international coalition of groups, but the leadership is, by and large, all U.S. Christian right. And it is kind of pan-Christian. There is a lot of diversity among the Christians, but there is really not the interfaith diversity that they like to claim. So while they claim we're representing all of the children of Abraham, you know, all of the monotheistic religions against this common enemy of relativism and modernism and secularism and reproductive rights, really, I mean, what they're uniting is the Mormon right, the evangelical right, and the Catholic right. And they're bringing them together. Occasionally, they will make common cause with some Muslim right organizations at the UN or places like that. And they have a little bit of support from Orthodox conservative Jewish groups as well. But by and large, it's a pan-Christian right group. And they're really kind of working to export their ideology to European countries, as I see it, as well as a few Latin American countries.
Well, and their tactics when they go to Europe with this are blatantly anti-Muslim, correct?
Blatantly, if you know what to look for. Blatantly, if you know kind of how to read between the lines. I think to any critics, it's very obvious that when they say things like they said in their campaign literature for this World Family World Congress for Families that they held last May in Warsaw, they used this idea that Poland is going to save Europe again. And what they were doing there is referencing this very old holy war from 1683, where Poland led this blatantly Christian army, they called it the Holy League and the Holy Army, against the invading Ottoman Empire. And so, you know, without talking about that, when they are using that ancient holy war as a new metaphor for Poland's role as a conservative bastion in liberal Europe, then what they're saying is, yes, pretty blatant. You know, we need the Christian soldiers from Christian countries to repel these invading Muslims. And so when they're talking about immigrants with little rights, obviously that's very dangerous.
A lot of Americans tend to think of Europe as pretty liberal, but this demographic winter scare seems to be making some inroads over there. What kind of policy developments are happening because of this?
I think a few of the ones particular to demographic winter are this idea of baby bonuses and birth initiatives, and seen that particularly in Italy and Russia. In Russia, they had kind of a comical spin on that. They had something called the Day of Conception back in September, where they were giving residents of this one town time off work in order to conceive a patriot for the country. And if you succeeded in conceiving and carrying to term a patriot for the country, 9 months later you could receive a refrigerator or a car. I think less comically and more blatantly, Italy and Europe have both started offering birth initiatives, so grants to families that will produce a second sibling. In Russia, it was close to $10,000. In Italy, it was closer to $1,000, which is kind of a laughably low figure for trying to bribe someone into having a second child.
Is there any kind of resistance to the scaremongering in Europe?
I think, as it stands right now, demographic winter is still kind of an argument that's being developed and being floated out to a broader audience than just the Christian right that already accepts this. So I look forward to seeing what will happen. I think that certainly across the board there are always activists and workers who are struggling against the conservative movements in their country. In Poland, which has taken a really upsetting and distressing conservative turn with its new coalition government, I know that there are a lot of reproductive rights workers and gay rights activists who are struggling against this with really a degree of persecution that we probably can't imagine here in the States, and just kind of targeting these groups with full government support. So I think that they would recognize this as, you know, just more of the same rhetoric that is driving their country to the far right. And so I think they would be struggling against this as part of their resistance in general. I think it remains to be seen, I guess, how that's going to happen kind of at a larger scale across Europe, whether or not they're going to allow themselves to be kind of sold this bill of goods, that the answer to their immigration problems is that women need to start having babies, and, you know, stop putting their own fulfillment and their own careers first, and really kind of transfer that back to this idea of the natural family. I hope that they will recognize that for what it is and turn away from it, but I think that remains to be seen.
Can you elaborate a little on the threat that this kind of argument presents to gay rights? Because I don't know if I necessarily get the connection there.
Yeah, and you wouldn't, as a sensible person, really. But I think that what they're saying is behind this whole idea of the demographic winter, the positive thing that they want to push, their kind of their utopian ideal, is what they call the natural family. The World Congress of Families leaders have written a document called the Natural Family Manifesto, which describes in detail what the natural family is and how the government should be involved with promoting that. And in it, it's not so much an anti-gay rights document, it's just it foresees a world in which gays don't exist, in which abortion and birth control don't really exist, because this is their utopian document, and things like reproductive rights and gay rights stand in the way of that. I think also they see in their rhetoric, they describe gay rights as being another kind of permissive liberal decadence that has allowed the demographic winter to come about. If you are allowing gays to have rights and you're allowing them to be open about that, then that changes the notion of sexuality from something that is necessarily tied to procreation to something that does not have a necessarily procreative role in reproducing the state. So I think that's kind of where that ties in.
Do you think we could start seeing Europeans get friendlier towards more coercive measures like restricting access to contraception or abortion?
I think you already do see that in Eastern European countries. I spoke with a reproductive rights activist in Poland, and she told me that essentially, though this is not codified in law, essentially all of the public clinics are abiding by the general Catholic mores of the country. And so if you want to get contraception, you really have to go to a private clinic. And I think you're seeing a lot of the same kind of mentality towards these things sweeping across the Eastern European countries that are a little bit newer to democracy and a lot of which seem to be undergoing real conservative evolutions right now.
You can check out Catherine's article at The Nation or a reprint of it at RH Reality Check. Well, thank you very much for coming on to RealityCast, Catherine.
Thanks so much, Amanda.
Okay, I can't let the Elliot Spitzer thing go. While a lot of people just want to look away from sex scandals, I can't help but think that the silver lining in even the tawdriest sex scandals is the way it exposes people's attitudes about sex, marriage, and yes, even reproductive rights. In this case, the real source of the scandal was not just the money laundering, but the prostitution. Prostitution is a crime, and one that Spitzer doggedly enforced in his prosecutor days. So I feel perfectly comfortable with the fact that he's having to face the music on this issue. But what I really find interesting in the fallout is how little people care about the men's behavior, and how everything always, without fail, goes back to judging and evaluating women's behavior. Exhibit number one. All the interest in how Silda Wall Spitzer handled the fallout. Rebecca Traister at Salon vlogged this issue.
The question that seems to be returning to everybody's lips over and over again is not about the dirty stuff. It's a question about why his wife, Silda Wall Spitzer, stood next to him both on Monday at his press conference in which he apologized and on Wednesday morning at the press conference in which he resigned. Since there's been political scandal, there have been wives who have stood next to their husbands in moments of apologetic, shameful resignations. But for some reason, Silda Wall Spitzer's choice to appear in the frame next to her husband in this instance has incited an enormous amount of anger and incredulity far into the future whenever we see an image of Elliot Spitzer's once promising career crashing and burning. We'll also see an image of his aggrieved and humiliated wife. There are a lot of questions about why this is striking such a powerful nerve. I've spoken to some people who are really angry at him. They assume that he asked her to stand next to him. We don't actually know who asked and who insisted on what. Others are questioning why she might want to stand next to him.
That we almost care more about the whys of Silda Spitzer's behavior than Elliot Spitzer's behavior is sad. It says a lot more about how it's easier to judge a woman in this society. We're more comfortable judging a woman than a man, even when he's openly hurt her like this. Then there's the issue of the prostitute. My biggest frustration when talking about prostitution is no matter how hard you try to keep the subject on why men get involved in being johns and pimps, invariably the conversation drifts over to why women are prostitutes. I started not one but two threads at pandagon.net about the issue of male responsibility for prostitution, and in both cases, the threads devolved into a pissing match on whether or not feminist critiques of prostitution were insulting to women's agency or what. The role of men was completely forgotten. Are we afraid of demanding better, more responsible behavior from men? One thing is for certain. Our society loves to heap shame on women for being sexual. Jay Smooth had a vlog going around that got a lot of fist pumps from the feminists out there about the prostitute in question and her hopes for a recording career, hopes that are getting dashed by a music industry suddenly interested in morals.
Check out this quote from the A&R director at Capitol Records and see if you can catch the reason why it sounds good but actually makes no sense. I think her song is absolutely terrible. If people are interested in signing her, then they shouldn't be in the music business. It'd be a shame to exploit her talent based on the unacceptable reality that she was involved in. Okay, so you don't think we should ever give out a record deal based on the scandalous details of somebody's criminal past? That makes sense. Except for the fact that almost every record deal you gave out to every rapper in the last 15 years was based on the scandalous details of their criminal past. You guys love to exploit someone's talent based on the unacceptable reality they were involved in. As long as that unacceptable reality involves selling crack and shooting people, but if it involves having sex, that's suddenly an unthinkable moral outrage.
I love the vlog, but I have to notice that once again the question of men in the prostitution business gets set aside. He's right about how women are mistreated and considered tainted by sex, but let's go a step further. It's not just selling crack and murder that is glamorized by who gets a record contract and who doesn't. It's also pimping. A prostitute is considered an unacceptable person to give a contract to, but someone who brags about being a pimp can't hand him money fast enough. Now for the wisdom of wingnuts. I was Googling around looking for more information about these ridiculous anti-choicers trying to make the movie Horton Hears a Who about their pet issue. And I found that one anti-choicer, unsatisfied with the fact that the original story doesn't actually have talking fetuses, rewrote the story so that it has talking fetuses.
There, sitting in pink clover, not making a sound, sat a young lady, her tummy was round. I know, thought the elephant, the cry came from there. She's quiet as a mouse and there's no one else near. Then one more time came the voice from within. I'm here! I'm here! It said again and again. Morton the elephant spoke. Isn't that funny? The voice I heard came from inside her tummy.
The mother in this story is there because she kind of has to be. She's the container for the all-important fetus. But she doesn't talk, and the story makes sure to make a point of this, because acknowledging that women exist, much less that they can talk and think and have feelings, unlike embryos, screws the whole story up. Better to pretend they're silent containers.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.